Okay, so we're going to have a chance for some discussion and question and answer about Rinpoche's teaching. The other night and this morning. So does anyone have anything, first of all, that they'd like to ask? Yes.
Could you just please go over verse 9 and 10?
Verse 9 and 10.
11 and 12.
No, 9 and 10. I understand in verse 10 that it lists the three qualities of true cessation and the three qualities of the true path. And I think I got that in verse 10, but I don't know where they're explained in verse 9. And then Rinpoche said there's eight qualities in verse 9, and I have no idea how you come up with eight.
Wow.
I have no idea. So just to put some perspective on this, we're talking about the qualities of the triple gem. In Tibetan, they say Khonchok Sum. You know what the Sanskrit is for triple gem? Triratna. It's the same like in like tricycle. We say where does tri come from? Latin, is it? So in the Sanskrit has a lot of connection with the Latin and some of our other languages. So the same word for three, triratna, means the triple gem. The Tibetans put it as konchok. They took ratna as that which is rare and supreme. So they made it a little bit longer. So sometimes you see the rare supreme ones. But basically, it's just meaning the three gems. And this text, the Uttara Tantra by Maitreya, in the first chapter that we're studying, is going over near the beginning here, after it discusses the seven Vajra points that are mentioned in the whole text, it starts to go into the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha jewels and the actual definition. So if you read some of the Lanrim texts that give definitions of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, sometimes they quote some of these verses from Uttara Tantra. So we're on the section, the question is about the section on the Dharma jewel. Okay, and so that starts on with verse 9, goes up 10, 11, and 12. And then verse 13 starts with a Sangha jewel, right? So it's a little bit, because the text itself is very profound and very condensed, and they're also a bit obscure because it's very profound. As one, who was it that asked the question this morning about, you know, all this is very complicated, but I want to ask something more simple. I'm not here right now. So, So let's see. Let's take a look at this section on the Dharma. Basically, let me ask you first of all, what is the Dharma jewel? What is the actual Dharma jewel? Is it the texts or what? Eric, do you know the words? The Buddha's word is the Dharma. Holding the realizations is the Dharma. Dorji is agreeing with you. Okay, that must mean that's a good answer.
Yes, the main turnings of the Dharma wheel.
Main turnings of the Dharma wheel. That's the Dharma jewel. That's what we take refuge in. Rita?
The path of cessation.
The path? What did you say?
Path and
dissociations. Path and
closer.
I don't think you'd say the ultimate and conventional. But okay, so we're getting closer there. I think the actual Dharma jewel, or final Dharma jewel, is the true path and true cessations, or we could say true cessations and true paths, right? Do you know what true, you know, that's because the Dharma jewel is that which protects us, holds us up from suffering. The word Dharma comes from a Sanskrit root, drir, I think, that means to hold up. That's why the word phenomena, we often translate Dharma in one of the other meanings of Dharma as phenomena, that which upholds its own identity. Okay, so here Dharma, when we're talking about is that which holds us from suffering, the pure Dharma, the holy Dharma. And what really holds us from suffering, let's say ultimately, finally, the actual Dharma, are the true cessations which are exist within the minds of who? Of all bodhisattvas? They have to be Arya beings, those who have realized emptiness directly, right? Someone who's just entered the path, who's developed actual bodhicitta, they don't yet have true cessations in their mind, do they? Or do they? Don't they have cessation of self-cherishing thought? Well, later in the Uttara Tantra, even that, it says that even until the eighth bhumi, one has some kind of self-cherishing thought. But here, what we're talking about, cessation means the total elimination of the klesha, the afflictions, like anger, attachment, ignorance, self-grasping, all the passions, the total elimination of them so that they will never return again in such a way that they're abandoned along with their seeds, that which gives rise to them. Even when say right now, maybe you're not angry. Let me see. Maybe someone's angry. Let me see. Anyone? No one looks angry right now. But you still may have the seed of anger, the potential to give rise to anger in your mind. There's something even more subtle than that, the imprints of anger. But here, on the path of seeing, when one becomes an Arya being, for the first time, you have the ability, through realizing emptiness, to cease completely the seeds of certain afflictions, along with the afflictions and their seeds, so that they will never come back again. And subsequently, as you meditate further along the path, on the path of meditation, you are abandoning and obtaining true cessations of more and more of these afflictions. So you do, in fact, when do you actually have total cessation of the afflictions? Darcy knows, I think. When, at what point would a Hinayana practitioner have cessation of all the afflictions? Yeah.
When they remove all their aspirations to Nirvana.
What stage would that be?
Path of seeing.
On the path of seeing? They'd have total cessation of all the afflictions?
Of the klesha.
No. No, because on the path of seeing, they cease or abandon all of the intellectually formed afflictions, but not until they attain arhatship. Arhatship is further along than becoming an Arya or superior being, right? And how about in the bodhisattva path? Diana, do you know? When would a bodhisattva have abandoned all of the afflictions? When would they have total cessation of all the afflictions? No, I just said the afflictions, true cessation of all the afflictions.
On
the eighth bhumi, after finishing the seventh bhumi, on the beginning of the eighth bhumi, the bodhisattvas have a true cessation, like the arhats, of all of the afflictions. So that sometimes they're called Mahayana arhats at that point, in the three pure bhumis, the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis. So here in this section, this is when we're talking about the Dharma jewel. Basically, what we're talking about are these two things, true cessations and true paths. What are true paths, by the way? What is a true path? The Lanrim, is that a true path? Or does it depend if it's the Gelugpa or Nyingma, Lanrim, or what? Maybe one is true and the other is not, or what? What do you think, Rita? Pardon? The five paths are true paths? Path of preparation, path of accumulation, path of preparation? No, the actual true path here is not the five paths, the path of accumulation and so forth. That's not exactly right. It's not the eightfold Arya path. That's not what's meant in this context. Although in some presentations, the Hinayana, when they talk about true path, they talk about that. The true path here means meditative equipoise on emptiness, direct realization of emptiness. So true paths are the causes of true cessations, right? You can say, in a sense, true cessations are permanent, so they don't have actual causes, but they're the condition that bring about true cessations. So an Arya being, the only person who has a true path within their mind stream is an Arya being. Likewise, the only person who has true cessation in their mind stream is an Arya. Do you know what, do you know, this young lady back there, do you know what an Arya being is?
Right.
It's a Sanskrit word that could mean superior. We could translate it as superior and so forth. So here, this section 9, 10, 11, and 12 that's talking about the Dharma jewel, basically it's talking about that. When one of the folks over here mentions the actual, so they were saying the ultimate Dharma jewel is true paths and true cessations, but the conventional Dharma jewel was the scriptures or something. Actually, what we say is the final or actual Dharma jewel are the true paths and true cessations, and that which represents the Dharma jewel, representational Dharma jewel, are the scriptures and the teachings that can bring about slowly that actual Dharma jewel. They're not the actual Dharma jewel, although we pay reverence to them because they're like the causes that can bring about that understanding, that realization, the true paths within our consciousness and the true cessations, which are the abandonments of the afflictions within our mind stream. So here, so now that's just sort of making, you know, a little finer picture before diving into the details here. So, Diana, was it you who asked the question? Okay. What was it? Verse number 10?
Qualities of true cessation, the three qualities of true paths. So, my understanding is the three qualities of true path are pure, clear, and antidotal, and the three qualities of true cessation are unthinkable without the two afflictive emotions. Is that correct?
Without the two and without conception.
Oh, yeah, and without conception.
Right, I think that's right.
And then
here is antidotal, not anecdotal, right? In case you got confused by that, okay.
What I was wondering is where those qualities are found in verse 9.
Okay, that's one of the questions. That's one of the questions I was asking Rupshe,
because it gets a little bit complicated. So 9 is a general introduction. 10 and part of 11 is kind of connected with 11 is a little more the straight presentation. And number 12 is kind of like a condensation again. That's how all of these sections have been. There's kind of an introduction, and then there's a presentation, and then there's a condensation at the end. Some of you who've studied some of the philosophical texts may remember that from many of the texts that we've studied. There'll be a presentation like that. There's an introduction that's brief, and then an elaborate explanation, and then a condensation at the end, a summary, you might say. So here, the eight qualities of the Dharma jewel are its inconceivability. Here it says unthinkable. You could say inconceivable. Lacking two or being without the two, and that meant karma and klesha. Do you know those two words? Here it says contaminated actions and afflictive emotions. So actions here we say are karma, and it doesn't mean all karma, it means those that are still afflicted by the, contaminated by the motivating force of afflictions, and without the kleshas, without the afflictions also. And the third quality is non-conceptual, without conception. Those three correspond to qualities of true cessations. right? And then the other three, pure, being clear, and being antidote, are qualities of the true path. And then these two, the statement of true paths and true cessations are the last two qualities. That is to say, if you were to ask, what are these divisions, eight divisions of the Dharma jewel, two of the divisions I think would be true paths and true cessations, the last two. Okay. So here in the 12th verse, I was asking Rinpoche a little bit about the connection between that and the 11th, the 10th, the 12th, the 10th, and the 9th verse. So it's inconceivable or unthinkable, according to the root text here, because of the first three factors in verse 9. That is to say, the first three being, first of all, there's this analysis of this fourfold kind of analysis, right? Phenomena do not exist. Let's say phenomena are devoid of being non-existent. They're devoid of being existent, that is truly existent. They're devoid of being existent and non-existent, that is devoid of being both existent and non-existent. And they're devoid of being neither existent nor non-existent. That's the first of these qualities in verse 9. So that's just talking about one, sort of this kind of analysis. That's one part of the inconceivability of the true cessation. And then it says here in verse 12, it is unthinkable or inconceivable because of being unanalyzable in those four ways. Inexpressible, that's the next quality in verse 9, devoid of description. And it is unthinkable because it is known by Arya beings, known by superiors. So that's equivalent in verse 9 to known by oneself individually. And then it's in verse 12, it says, due to being pacified or quiescent, it is without the two, that is without afflictions and without karma, contaminated karma, and due to being quiescent, it is without conceptions, without improper conceptions, conceiving of true existence. So I think what that means is that one word, quiescent, in verse 9 is referring to, it has two kinds of quiescence or pacification of the adventitious stains and quiescence of the natural stains. And then the last part of that verse says the three, purity and so forth, purity, clear, and antidote, which are the next three in verse 10, those are like the sun, which means that they illuminate. Those are the qualities of the true path, which illuminate the phenomena so that we can actually develop true cessations and realize their actual nature. Now, having said that, how does that stand? Is that more or less what you understood also? Yeah. Okay, wait, let's just see if she has some.
Maybe it doesn't fit this. I was trying to figure out. I'm still trying to figure out in verse 9 how the eight are
okay.
Listed.
So the eight are, I think the eight are listed this way.
The son of the excellent doctrine kind of comes at the end. That's a quality that's kind of like of all of the, here it says the excellent dharma, like we say sadharma, That's the quality of the Dharma jewel, like being a sun. So not where it says not non-existent and so forth, up to the point in the third line when it says and not analyzable as other than existent and non-existent. Up to that point, that's one of the eight qualities, one part of the eight qualities. That's one part of being inconceivable. Devoid of description, according to verse 12, is also part of inconceivability, being incapable of being described. And another facet of inconceivability, the first point, is known by oneself individually. So self, something that it's inconceivable, it can't be described, and it can't be transmitted by others. You have to know it yourself, like tasting chocolate. We gave example yesterday, or gelato, or whatever. Okay, so those up till there, that's all talking about the first of the eight points. Then quiescent refers to two of the points. It refers to being without two, like in verse 12. That means without the two things, contaminated actions and afflictive emotions. Or in verse 10, where it says unthinkable or inconceivable, that was what we did up till there. Quiescent refers to without two and without conception. Okay? Without conception of true existence. Then undefiled, illumined with the light rays of exalted wisdom. Other people put that's what I was asking Rinpoche, where the undefiled went. It looks like that's actually another adjective or adverb in that sentence. Illumined with the light rays of stainless exalted wisdom. That word undefiled could be translated as stainless. So that's referring to these last three qualities, the next three qualities, pure, clear, and antidote. That last statement. Does that help? Okay. So, Leo, you had some observation. Your question was her question?
Yeah.
Was her answer your answer also? Or?
Make sure I got your answer to her question, yeah. Which was my question correct.
Question.
Non-existent, and non-existent, and non-analyzable as other than existent, non-existent.
Okay, what is that all talking about? Let's stop there. First of all,
I wanted to ask you, and my question was: is something like non-existent? Is that like a chittamatra?
No. Let's just look at it this way. Generally, when Nargarjuna, the great Mahayana saint, who sort of revived the Mahayana in the world some 400, 500 years after Buddha's passing, he was prophesied by Buddha himself to reinvigorate the Mahayana teachings, which had been more or less kept secretly. What had sort of proliferated in the world and was well known were the Hinayana teachings, the tradition of the elders, the Staiviras, which today is called the Theravada, right? And the other Hinayana schools, the 18 Vaibhashika schools and some other offshoots of that. So that was mainly what was overtly practiced. And those who were Mahayana, upholding the Mahayana, seemed to be not so well known. They might have been practicing in secret, and because it was not as popular, that altruistic sense at that point. Nargarjuna again invigorated those teachings by elaborating about the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and one of the things that he mentioned a lot in his teachings was kind of a four-point analysis. If things were to exist, let's say if you were to analyze something, that let's say the phenomena would either exist or not exist, But there's some other possibilities. Maybe it's something a little more subtle. It both exists and doesn't exist. Or it's none of those four qualities. You can't describe it as being existent or non-existent. In many of Nagarjuna's arguments, this kind of analysis was brought forth, four kinds of analyses like that. So that's what's being referred to here in this first, not necessarily referring to Nagarjuna, but that kind of analysis. So when we talk about whether phenomena exist, the general tendency of the mind is to think that they're truly existent, which the Mahayana says phenomena are not truly existent. But here when it's talking about they neither exist truly, nor are they truly non-existent. One might think, well, if it, Mahayana, as you say, it doesn't truly exist, it doesn't exist at all. And so the person might actually hold on to that phenomena as being truly non-existent. That's not the case either. The Mahayana would say, no, that's not the case. It's not non-existent. And then they would say, oh, maybe, okay, oh, it's not that. Then it's both existent and non-existent, still in the person's mind holding on to that kind of combination as being something which exists truly or ultimately. Ultimately existent and non-existent. Mahayana would say, no. Then they're finally scratching their head and say, well, okay, it's neither existent nor non-existent. Still holding on to that kind of state as being truly existent. Mahayana would say, no. And then the people would go crazy, jump in the lake or whatever, you know, after none of those four possibilities. So sometimes people incorrectly call Nagarjuna's teachings nihilistic, saying that just sort of like denying everything. But that's not the case at all, because it's a subtle, to understand how phenomena actually do exist conventionally as mere names or concepts goes beyond these kinds of four kinds of analyses. Okay? So that's that, those many, many lines, existent, non-existent, all of that is just talking about this four kinds of analyses. And later in the in verse 12, where it says it is unthinkable or inconceivable, that's the first quality of the Dharma jewel, because it's unanalyzable in these four ways. True paths and true cessations, any kind of phenomena, are unanalyzable in these ways. They're inexpressible, and they're only known by one's own experience. They're known through an Arya being, a superior being's own experience.
That phrase isn't an endorsement of crossing Gita versus Bhagavad Tantra or anything. It's simply an assertion of the two truths. Would that be correct?
This fourfold analysis? You could take it, I think Prasangika could take it as, Svatantrika would also have a similar kind of analysis, but Prasangika would, using that analysis in a more subtle way, they would say, actually, you Svatantrikas, that's another school of the Majjhimaka, right, are not applying this correctly, because the Svatantrika has some subtle incorrectness about their view. Okay, let's see. Now, feel free, if you want, if that gentleman's around, to ask. Where is that? Yeah.
I'm almost there. Okay. Hold on. Obviously, not in the correct words, but could you say then that nothing really exists because of how we perceive it? So that, like you said about tasting something, until you're what, an Arya or of that of an enlightenment place, then it's understood as existing and not existing. Is it because of sit?
No.
Okay. Here, what we're talking about is, let's say, the perception of ultimate truth, the perception of shunyata. Have you heard that word before? Shunyata, emptiness. So the perception of emptiness. One can have a perception of emptiness before being an Arya being, definitely. But it won't be a direct perception. Direct perception in the sense of like we see things with our eyes directly without the interceding of any kind of conceptual thought. You actually see something directly, or you taste it, you touch it, you smell it, you know, you hear it, whatever. So there is a way to know phenomena with our mind, not only through concepts, as we do now. It's essentially almost the only way. There are some exceptions. For the most part, our mind now deals only with conceptual thought, knowing things in a way that we think is the only way that our mind can know, through thinking. But it is possible to train the mind in such a way when it gets familiar with a phenomena such as emptiness or truth or impermanence. It is possible for the mental consciousness to know that barely, nakedly, without the interference, you might say, without the intermediary of a mental image of it, knowing, you know, thinking about it. It is possible to know it directly. So when we're talking about the true path is not just meditation on emptiness that we do now. That's kind of an analog of true path. It's not the actual true path. Actual true path is when our meditative equipoise on emptiness, when we've realized emptiness conceptually, and that mental image slowly is dissipated over time through familiarity, and we have a direct realization of emptiness. It's at that point that we know phenomena. We know the phenomena of emptiness directly. We become an Arya being. We have our first cessation, true cessation of the affliction, so that they'll never come back again. Okay. Anyone else? When you become an arhat? Yeah, that's what I should ask you that one. What's the difference between an arya and an arhat? I have to go back to the exams now.
I thought I knew, but I forgot. So that's why I'm asking.
Okay, I'll just tease it.
An arya, a superior being, is someone who has realized emptiness directly. Is realizing or has realized. That is to say, I think at the very moment in meditative equipoise, when you have a direct realization of emptiness, you are an Arya being. So you can continue that state on the path of seeing and on the path of meditation successively over the years, months, lifetimes perhaps, meditating on emptiness and eliminating, like peeling an onion, peeling off more and more layers of the delusions, ceasing more and more of the delusions. When you get to the very end of the delusions or the afflictions, the klesha that have to be removed, when the last veil or obscuration klesha is removed, abandoned, you become an arhat. So in the Mahayana tradition, one of the etymologies of arhat means foe destroyer. So someone who has totally destroyed the enemy or foe of the klesha. Doesn't necessarily mean one is a Buddha, because there are even more subtle things.
That was the removal of the intellectually formed
both intellectually formed and the innate obstructions to liberation.
Not the
obstructions to omniscience. So if you were to follow the Hinayana path and become an arhat, you'd be in pretty good shape. You would have, you would be free from samsara. You would have attained nirvana. You would be an arhat. Would you be an Arya being, or could you have skipped being an Arya being? No way to skip. Come on. You probably skipped sixth grade or something, didn't you? No way to skip, because there's no way that you can eliminate the delusions, become an Arya until you've become an arhat, until you've become an Arya. You have to become an Arya first. When you're an Arya being, you are an actual Sangha. Actual Sangha, as we'll be seeing in more detail probably this afternoon, actual Sangha means an Arya being, a person who has realized emptiness directly. That's the final or actual sangha. Representational sangha means four or more fully ordained monks. Yes.
This question, it feels like it's a stupid question, but I'm going to try to get it out anyway. I can't understand why human beings would have a functioning that seems so wasteful, that we have, in order to perceive things as they are, seems to take so much work, and yet it would seem like, why couldn't we just perceive things as they are? I don't know how to ask the question.
It would seem that way, wouldn't it?
Why is it so difficult?
Because it wreaks so much damage on other beings, yeah, and the whole universe. It just seems very odd.
Yeah. Tell that to my mind. Mind. We have familiarized ourselves with ignorance since beginningless time. This is from a Buddhist understanding. Phenomena appear to us due to our karma. You know, what is otherwise has no particular appearance, the karmic, the dependent arising that gives rise to phenomena, this little recorder and, oops, I hope I didn't turn it off, the recorder, these eyeglasses, to a Buddha they have no particular appearance. To our senses, due to our karma, they have a particular appearance. And on a certain level, conventionally, we say, they could be considered to have a certain validity. We say they're conventional truths. They're not really true, these phenomena, but they are said to be conventionally true for the obscured mind, like our minds. The big problem is that we, because of the imprints in our mind, our familiarity with this belief in some kind of real existence here, real glass, real wristwatch, real recorder, as soon as we label things, as something is introduced to us, you know, this is a glass, this is a wristwatch, or, you know, we see it and say, oh, that's a wristwatch over there. As soon as we label things, which is legitimate in terms of their conventional reality, it seems as though that what we have labeled from our side, conceived of, actually is existing out there, as though there's a real thing out there, real phenomena existing from its own side, truly. The real, the origin of our problem isn't with our own ego identity. What's your name?
Catherine.
Catherine has a conception, not, you know, in the same way as wristwatch and other things, you have a conception of yourself. And it seems within your mind that there is a real findable Catherine who is kind of like the organizer. I can tell you're very organized, restrained, you know, intelligent, you know, get things done. It's that sense within your mind of who you are that we sometimes call soul or ego or self. When we say, who am I? If I say, who are you? You say, well, I'm Catherine. And if I inquire more, if you look in your own mind, there's a sense of who you are. Not, I don't mean just intellectually. Oh, I'm an American Californian lady who's done this and that. I don't mean intellectually. Just the sense of your own being, your own self-existence. That also is something that has been with us since beginningless time, that kind of belief in our own self-identity. That gives rise to our anger, that gives rise to attachment, wanting to please the self. Why else do you take a piece of chocolate and put it on your tongue? Is it so that there is just pleasant taste in the tongue consciousness? No, it's because I want to experience, I, George or Catherine, wants to experience, as though there is another Catherine behind there who's the experiencer. So in a certain sense, what we're studying here, these kind of philosophical subjects, helps to go to get down to the real core of what the problem is. Otherwise, we can talk about things in a more elementary sense, say that the problem is our karma, and it's better not to create negative karma, try to create good karma, virtuous karma, and avoid negative karma. And in the future lives, you'll have more pleasure then. But that you'll still be within cyclic existence that way, right? So if you really get down to the core, how can I get out of cyclic existence, this unsatisfying, maybe someone will say it's very satisfying. You probably say it's satisfying. Now you're leaning on Bob's shoulder, so it's very satisfying. But that's just samsara. No, don't get angry at me, Bob, for saying that. Okay. Not that Bob is only samsara. We're all samsara. There's no real ultimate satisfaction to be found within cyclic existence. At first, when we encounter that, we might think, that sounds really Buddhist. Sounds like, there's got to be some pleasure somewhere, you know, Times Square or Santa Cruz or I don't know where, you know, or love. Love is real pleasure, right? We might think, if you analyze again and again all of the things that we hold as very precious and important in our lives, you can find that there's no real pleasure the way that our mind conceives. At the most, we can find relief, eliminating one thirst or itch, replacing it with some other kind of discomfort, like the leper who scratches, you know, a person with a scab or sore, scratching it and feeling, that's really good. And if I told them, you know, actually, it would be much better. There's not real pleasure. Don't scratch it. You should take the antidote to that. And they might think, if I took the antidote to that, what do you call it, sore, I wouldn't have the pleasure of scratching any longer. Right? So if Elizabeth took the antidote to attachment, she might think there'd be no more pleasure, you know, of attachment. You know, a following attachment, being close to people or, you know, whatever. So these are all on grosser levels. When we get down to the core, let's say the nitty-gritty. Do we still say that? The nitty-gritty? When you get down to the nitty-gritty, what do we actually have to do? We have to develop what's the real dharma that protects us from suffering. All the other dharma that we learn, the dharma teachings that talk about good heart and, you know, trying to have a positive mind, not to be angry and so forth, all of those are kind of temporal antidotes. The actual dharma are true paths, the actual realization of emptiness, direct realization of emptiness, which recognizes, say, Catherine doesn't exist at all the way that she conceives of herself to exist. You know, you say, I do not exist at all the way I conceive myself to exist. Not just saying that, you know, because Buddha said, and I'm a Buddhist, therefore I have to believe, but actually analyzing and realizing that, the reality of that, having a real experience of that, that's what actually protects one from suffering. And the result of those true paths, in a sense, is the elimination of all of the problems in our mind, all of the klesha, all of the afflictions, bringing about actual cessation of them so they'll never come back again. Not just like going on vacation and no longer being angry for a week. How long's your vacation? You have a week? 2 weeks? No vacation. You know, maybe you go to Hawaii or someplace and, you know, for 2 weeks, no problems. No jealousy, no attachment, no one to get angry at. But those are not ceased. It's just temporarily absent, you know, unmanifest within your mind. To actually cease them, you need to realize emptiness. You need to realize, rely on the Dharma jewel. That's what actually protects us from suffering. Okay? So any last question? We'll take a break. Yeah, Sky.
Beings and the direct perception of emptiness. You know, the mind book from Ladi Rinpoche, it mentions in there about facsimile direct perception. And I'm wondering at which point, how would you know it is facsimile direct perception? And if you identify it, how do you then change that to
direct?
First of all, it would be good to even have a facsimile of a direct perception of emptiness. Right now, we probably don't even have that. The stages of developing a direct realization of emptiness are well laid out in the sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. You know, accumulating merit, meditating again and again on the intellectual understanding that one has, that one can ascertain over time as being factually correct. Then, at a certain point, one sort of recognizes where one is. It's not as though one is just one day, I don't know, what do you say, a doofus? One day you're a jerk, and then suddenly you sit down in meditation, and suddenly you've realized emptiness directly, and everything is changed. There is a gradual development, and you would know that you're approaching that kind of direct realization of emptiness. Okay, so you would know when you had a conceptual understanding of emptiness, which is kind of like a facsimile of direct perception of emptiness, and you would know when that transforms, because one of the factors of a direct realization of emptiness is that on the liberated path, one has a clear realization that one has ceased the delusions, certain delusions, so that they'll never come back again. Okay, so let's stop there, give a chance to prepare for Rinpoche's talk.